A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We were going to be talking with Amy Bellantoni, a Second Amendment attorney in New York. Fortunately, had an unscheduled issue, so we'll hopefully get Amy back on the program later this week, talking about the latest in a case called Mills versus New York City. Also, before we get started, do want to say congratulations to John Petrolino, named Journalist of the Year at the Gun Rights Policy Conference in San Diego, California over the weekend. Congratulations to John Costas Moros, also received an award, Second Amendment attorney. I believe Rob Dorf from the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus recognized for his work advocating for the right to keep and bear arms as well. So congratulations to everybody who was recognized by the Second Amendment Foundation at the Gun Rights Policy Conference over the weekend in San Diego. I was sadly unable to be there in person. I did attend the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms board meeting virtually. But hopefully, fingers crossed, knock on wood, next year I will be able to attend GRPC in person. It is an amazing event, and I'm glad that it was such a successful weekend there in San Diego. All right, so today we're going to be talking about Kamala Harris. And yes, her recent comments in that streaming event with Oprah Winfrey, where she said, "Oh, yeah, I'm a gun owner, and anybody who comes to my house are getting shot." Oh, I probably shouldn't have said that. Ooh, my campaign staff will have to clear that up. Yeah, I think that whole thing was scripted. I've talked about this before. I think Kamala Harris knew exactly what she was saying. I don't think that this was something where her, you know, brain got ahead of her, or her mouth got ahead of her brain. This is, I think, by design to try to counter Kamala Harris's extensive history of extreme anti-Second Amendment activism, right? Calling for the ban on handguns in San Francisco in 2005, supporting Washington, D.C.'s ban on handguns in 2007, advocating for a interpretation of the Second Amendment that did not recognize an individual right to keep and bear arms in the Heller decision. You've got her war on gun shows when she was a DA in San Francisco, her comment about, well, just because you're a lawful gun owner behind locked doors, it doesn't mean we can't go in and, to your home and see how your guns are being stored as part of San Francisco's municipal gun storage ordinance. And as recently as 2022, calling the Supreme Court's decision in Bruin, saying it defied common sense in the Constitution, recognizing that the right to keep and bear arms not only protects the right to keep arms, but the right to bear them as well. Yeah, Kamala Harris now is talking about, oh, I'm a gun owner, I support the Second Amendment, and I support a ban on so-called, well, she doesn't call them so-called, a ban on assault weapons, which she says has no place in a civil society. Says her campaign anyway, says, well, now she's not in favor of a mandatory buyback, but she still refuses to explain the scope of her proposed gun ban or why she would not support a mandatory buyback, quote unquote, if she does not believe that commonly owned semi-automatic firearms like AR-15s belong in a civil society. Interestingly enough, the latest headline and story critiquing Kamala Harris's comments, Kamala Harris's dumb and incredibly dangerous rhetoric about guns, does not come from the right. Of course, they're not taking issue with Harris's support for any of those extreme gun control measures that I just mentioned. No, Furman de Brabander, who is a professor of philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art and the author of Do Guns Make Us Free? Here's a hint. He says no. Has a piece at the New Republic taking on Kamala Harris's comment or quip about somebody breaking into her home being shot. As he writes, I'm a gun owner. Tim Walz is a gun owner. Kamala Harris said in a recent interview with Oprah, and then she shocked her interview by adding, if someone breaks into my house, they're getting shocked or they're getting shot. She laughed. The audience laughed, and she seemed immediately contrite. I probably should not have said that. My staff will deal with that later. But what's there to fix or spin? He writes. Harris was being crystal clear, deadly serious, and I believe perfectly intentional. I do too. De Brabander says this is how she hopes to lure independents and erstwhile conservatives, especially in Midwestern swing states, by confidently and fluently speaking the language of gun owners. Okay, now that goes too far. As an electoral strategy, he writes, there may be some logic to it. In all other respects, he says, it's dumb and dangerous, pandering to fatal illusions and temptations about owning a gun. This is not, by the way, speaking the language of gun owners fluently. Kamala Harris has yet to detail what gun she owns, when she bought it, how often she trains, why she bought it, right? None of those things she wants to talk about. Now, and think about that for a second. In 2005, Kamala Harris backed Proposition H in San Francisco. That was a ban on handguns that required existing owners to turn them over to the San Francisco government. In 2007, she led district attorneys around the country to argue to the Supreme Court that the Second Amendment does not protect an individual right to keep and bear arms, and that Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban and storage requirements, by the way, that mandated guns be stored disassembled or locked up, with the ammunition stored separately, locked up, was constitutional. But at some point, she says, when she was a district attorney, she bought a gun. And she says that she bought a gun for self-defense. Now, that's a remarkable turnaround, right? In the span of just a couple of years, going from handguns should be banned and can be banned to buying a gun herself. Now, I suppose it's entirely possible that she purchased a gun for herself, believing that people like you and me should not be able to buy a handgun for self-defense. And if so, I'd like to hear that too. But she has not offered any explanation for what would seem to be a 180-degree turnaround on the issue of handgun ownership. She hasn't said when that turnaround happened. She hasn't detailed why she supposedly reversed course on you and I being able to purchase a handgun. And I would think that if Kamala Harris was not just a self-professed gun owner, but a real Second Amendment supporter, she'd be willing to have that conversation. In fact, she'd be eager to have that conversation, but she's not. So no, Kamala Harris isn't fluently speaking the language of gun owners. She is pretending to be a Second Amendment supporter. And as the Brabander said, the reason for that is simple. She's trying to attract moderates. She's trying to attract independent voters. She's trying to persuade even some conservatives that you can trust Kamala Harris with your right to keep and bear arms, even though her entire political history demonstrates that you can't. But again, the Brabander is upset with the fact that she is making this pitch for moderates. And he doesn't believe that Kamala Harris should have said, if anybody breaks into my house, we're getting shot. He writes, Harris never considers, for example, if her intruder is a criminal. That's presumed. What if he or she were mentally ill or disoriented by drugs? What if he made a mistake, like a delivery man who rocked on the wrong door? What if he just been in a bad car accident and needed urgent medical assistance for his passenger? That is, what if this person were unarmed and actually posed no physical threat? Would Harris shoot him down all the same? And what if he were armed with an AR-15? Would pulling a gun save her anyway? Well, maybe. Maybe not. And it doesn't matter if the intruder would have been armed with an AR-15 or a handgun or a knife. Owning a firearm is not a guarantee that you will never be harmed in a violent encounter with a dangerous criminal. But it does give you a fighting chance. And we have seen armed citizen stories where handgun owners have actually taken on individuals with AR-15s. There was a case out of West Virginia a couple of years ago where the guy with a semi-automatic rifle showed up at a party and was disarmed by a lawful gun owner who had a pistol with him. So if the Brabander is saying that, well, I mean, handguns no use because we got these weapons of war out there, no, he's wrong. He's wrong. Now, as for all of those other circumstances, I don't think that Harris's goal was to, you know, again, talk about, well, if somebody breaks into my house, they'd get shot, unless I realize they were, you know, involved in a serious accident. Again, she said they're, if someone breaks into their house, they're going to get shot. And she's right, by the way. She's got Secret Service protection. Are they going to ask, excuse me, sir, we know you just broke into the home, but are you suffering from delusions? Are you on drugs? Were you in an accident? Do you need help? No. If they perceive a threat to the vice president's life, they're going to shoot. And if the average homeowner has somebody breaking into their home in the middle of the night, you can assume they're not there to give you Girl Scout cookies. They're not there to compliment you on your drapes. If somebody breaks into your home in the middle of the night, you can assume. And again, we're not just talking about knocking on the door, right? Somebody on the other side of that door saying, help, I've been in an accident. No, you don't have a right to shoot somebody at that point. But if you believe that your life is in danger because somebody has broken into your home in the middle of the evening, or in broad daylight for that matter, but they are where they are not supposed to be, you are where you are supposed to be, and they pose a threat to you, yes, you have the right to defend yourself. You have the right to defend your family. And Fermanent Broadbander and other gun control activists don't think you do. DeBroadbander writes, "We are in the midst of a frightening arms race in America, as if our absurd civilian arsenal were not already massive enough. Once dominated by conservative white men, researchers note the ranks of gun owners continues to swell and grow more diverse." Oh, the horror. There are 400 million guns and 20 million assault rifles in America, he writes. Seemingly everyone now on all sides of the political and cultural spectrum is arming up. As the Wall Street Journal noted in a recent piece titled "The Most Surprising New Gun Owners Are U.S. Liberals," as of 2022, nearly 30% of Democrats and Democrat-leaning Americans now own a gun, up from 22% only a decade ago. During the pandemic, nearly 20% of new gun buyers were people of color, and black gun ownership has spiked 17 points since 2019. Half of new gun owners in 2020 were women, Vox reported last month, whereas only 9 to 14% of women owned guns between 1980 and 2014. No wonder we're fast approaching the day when half of American households have at least one gun. Oh, he hates that. He hates that because, again, it's not about reducing violent crime. It's not about improving public safety. It's about reducing the number of gun owners in this country. That's what gun control is all about, right? It's about demonizing and denormalizing this fundamental civil right. I'm happy that people who don't vote like me are starting to own firearms and exercise their Second Amendment rights. I hope that that will actually lead to an erosion of support for the types of extreme gun control measures that Kamala Harris has supported. Because if more Democrats start caring about their right to keep and bear arms, well, then maybe more Democratic politicians will back off of their desire to eradicate our right to keep and bear arms. But again, DeBroadbander sees this going in the wrong direction, right? And of course, DeBroadbander says, you know, owning a gun just makes you more dangerous, makes the country more dangerous, plays 400 million privately owned firearms. Oh, my goodness gracious. And yet, what's going on with crime in this country? According to the FBI, violent crime is down. Homicides down at an historic rate. And even DeBroadbander says, lost in all the hyperbole over crime and presidential candidates' rush to prove themselves tough on crime is a crucial fact. This country is growing safer with a notable decline in gun violence. Here in Baltimore, he writes, where there were more than 300 murders per year between 2015 and 2022, the city is on pace to fall below 200 this year for the first time in over a decade. Boston, recently celebrated by The Economist as America's safest city, has had just 14 murders in 2024. Most remarkably, he writes, this has happened without measurable changes in gun regulations, which our Supreme Court has effectively blocked. Baltimore and many other cities have invested in violence intervention programs where mediators negotiate brewing conflicts and persuade belligerents that it's not worth it to draw a gun. That message evidently works. Kamala Harris should try it, he writes. Yeah, it's not just that there have not been measurable changes in our gun laws, although it's good for DeBroadbander to note that. Is that the Supreme Court has actually, in cases like Bruin, caused states like Maryland to undo some of their restrictions. So Maryland was one of those may issue states. Across the entire state of Maryland before Bruin, had about 1,500 or so concealed carry licenses. And in order to get a concealed carry license in Baltimore, you had to demonstrate a justifiable need or good cause for you to carry. I live in a bad neighborhood was not seen as a valid reason to get a concealed carry license. Hey, I live in a city where there have been over 300 homicides per year. I want to be able to protect myself. Wasn't seen as a valid reason. You had to demonstrate that there was a specific threat, an ongoing threat against your life. And if you couldn't prove that there was a specific ongoing threat against your life, or that you worked in a job that was inherently dangerous, maybe worked with jewels, right? Or you delivered large sums of cash to the bank at the end of every evening. You were out of luck. You could not get a concealed carry license. Now, since Bruin, the state's may issue laws have shifted to shall issue, and you've had tens of thousands of Marylanders become concealed carry holders, over 80,000, I believe, just in the first year after Bruin. So an exponential increase in the number of people who are carrying firearms for self-defense on the streets of Baltimore. And what happened? Homicides are plummeting in Baltimore. So, yeah, it's not just, again, that this has happened without measurable changes in gun regulations. There have been measurable changes in the right direction in Maryland. Now, we still have a long way to go. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has upheld Maryland's ban on so-called assault weapons. That case could be heard by the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, in fact, could agree to hear that case in just a few weeks. The Fourth Circuit has also upheld Maryland's handgun qualification license, which is essentially a 30-day waiting period before folks can purchase or possess a handgun. You've got to go through, you know, mandated training and things of that nature. Again, barriers to lawful gun ownership, right? Not barriers to illegal gun ownership, but barriers to lawful gun ownership. So Maryland is not a perfect place. But even with those gun control restrictions, which, by the way, have been in place while Baltimore was experiencing 300-plus homicides a year, what has changed in Maryland is the fact that it is now far easier for the average citizen to exercise their right to carry. And it hasn't made the state a more dangerous place. It hasn't made Baltimore a more dangerous city. Now, DeBroadbander wants to give all the credit to things like community violence intervention programs. And listen, I think that those programs can be successful, but they also show you don't need new laws to reduce violent crime, right? You need to go after the people who are committing these crimes. And the most successful strategy, I think, uses a carrot and stick approach. So we know that you are the most, you know, you guys are the problems here. We know that you're the most prolific offenders. We know that the system has not always gone tough on you, but here's a promise. If you keep shooting, we're going to send you to federal prison. There will be no plea deal. There will be no plea bargain. You will go away for as long as the law allows. Now, if that doesn't sound appealing to you, there is another option. You can turn your life around. We'll get you job training. We'll get you counseling. We'll get you the help that you need in order to actually build a life on the right side of the law. That's a program, Operation Ceasefire. It's not officially in place in Baltimore. In fact, when Baltimore tried this a couple of decades ago, when Martin O'Malley was the mayor, I don't think he was really into it. He instead tried to adopt this, you know, arrest our way to safety philosophy. Lots of stops and frisks, lots of arrests for nonviolent possessory offenses, and crime went up. Operation Ceasefire, again, deals with those most prolific and violent offenders, those who are most at risk of becoming prolific and violent offenders, and offers them that choice. You can keep doing what you're doing, in which case we're going to put you behind bars for as long as we possibly can, or you can try to turn your life around and we're here to help. But either way, you're going to stop shooting. Now, DeBroadbender doesn't want to talk about that because, again, it doesn't involve new gun control laws. It doesn't involve demonizing gun owners. It doesn't involve denormalizing the right to keep and bear arms. It is an effective, proven strategy to reduce violent crime, and it is being deployed in cities across the country where violent crime is dropping. So, DeBroadbander's entire premise that Kamala Harris should not have talked about, well, if you come into my house, you're going to get shot. Because he says, you know, we got more people owning guns, which in turn will lead to more violent crime, except it's not leading to more violent crime. His entire premise is fundamentally flawed. Now, I will agree with him. I think Kamala Harris's comments to Oprah were politically calculated. And I think that the intent behind those comments was, again, to sort of defang her real views when it comes to the right to keep and bear arms. But I will also note that every time Kamala Harris has tried to talk this up, right? I'm a gun owner. You come in my house, you're going to get shot. It's always about her. Have you noticed that? It's not about you. It's not about me. It's not about the mom in Oakland who wants to be able to protect her family, or the young woman who lives in New York City who wants to be able to lawfully carry a firearm for self-defense, or the Strap hangers in Chicago who are tired of riding a public transit system that is beset and plagued by violent crime, and they want to be able to protect themselves. Now, it always comes back to her, right? I'm a gun owner. You come in my house, you'll get shot. Well, what about the rest of us? Because Kamala Harris, you know, she's one of the special people. Even when she supposedly bought a gun in California, she was the district attorney, so she could buy firearms that the average citizen would find it difficult to purchase, those off-roster handguns, right? The magazine limits didn't apply to Kamala Harris. And now, again, she's got Secret Service protection. So I think it's telling that Kamala Harris, when she does try to establish some sort of credibility as a moderate on this issue, it's not about your right. It's not about our right. It's about her ability to own a gun, right? It's about what would happen if somebody tried to break into her house, but not your house, not my house. And it's about the guns that she thinks we may or may not be able to own, as opposed to what the text of the Second Amendment and the national tradition of gun ownership in this country really says. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Let's start there with a case out of Virginia, as a matter of fact, Norfolk, Virginia. And, you know, we've heard, again, a lot of talk from the Biden-Harris administration about cracking down on bad apple gun dealers and cracking down on straw purchases. Well, I'm not convinced that we're really getting tough on these types of activities here. This is the headline from WAVY in Norfolk, Virginia. Woman sentenced to 30 days in jail for buying a gun for a teenager. Now, this wasn't buying a gun for, you know, somebody, okay, you're going to go to the range with me, we're going to go hunting. Mm-mm. Now, according to police, back on September 1st last year, 18-year-old, who was then 17-year-old, or 18-year-old Samanti Hill Smallwood was detained after Norfolk police discovered a handgun with a magazine in a vehicle that he was in. He told officers that a woman named Tiana Monet Johnson had purchased the handgun for him at a Norfolk gun shop as a gift. Investigators spoke then to the folks at the gun shop. They confirmed that Johnson was, in fact, the purchaser of this Glock in March of 2023 when Hill Smallwood was then 17 years of age. Johnson filled out the information and the background check form, but used a credit or a debit card with Hill Smallwood's billing information. Initially, when Johnson spoke to police, she lied. She told them that the gun had been stolen after she bought the firearm, but then she later admitted to buying the gun for the 17-year-old. So she was charged with possessing a firearm with the intent to transfer it to an ineligible person. The Commonwealth's attorney in Norfolk could have referred this case to federal court. They could have let the feds take up with this, right? And then Johnson would have been looking at a potential of 10 years behind bars. They did not. They ended up keeping the case in basically circuit court in Virginia. And Johnson, last Wednesday, took a plea deal. Pleaded guilty to one charge of making a false statement on a firearms background check form. In return, sentenced to 1 month in jail. That's it. Not 10 years, not 1 year, 1 month, 30 days. With another 1 year and 11 months suspended on the conditions that she complete 2 years of uniform good behavior and supervised probation after her release. That's it. So again, we could be getting tough on straw purchasers. The Biden-Harris administration says they're getting tough on straw purchasers. Democrats in Virginia say that we should be getting tough on straw purchasers. But when it comes down to it, we're not. We're still offering them plea deals and a slap on the wrist for something that Democrats keep saying is a very serious crime. Under today's Armed Citizen story, we don't have official confirmation here, but witnesses in Baltimore, again, talking about Baltimore, are saying that a fatal shooting may be connected to an attempted carjacking over the weekend, with the victim of that carjacking firing in self-defense. According to police dispatch audio, this was 8 p.m. on Saturday night. The 4100 block of Frederick Avenue, according to a police dispatch audio, Fox 45 in Baltimore reports that the 32-year-old victim of the shooting was attempting to carjack a driver on Augusta Avenue. The dispatcher said the call is coming out as a carjacking. Somebody was trying to steal a vehicle. The person whose car it was shot at the other person. Fox 45 also found video that shows the alleged carjacker running away from a white Honda before collapsing a short time later. A woman named Nia, who lives in the neighborhood and was once the victim of an attempted carjacking, saw what was going on. She said, a guy and his girlfriend ran up to me and my boyfriend, who was driving. My boyfriend at the time had fought him off with a gun. He ended up getting the gun. Nia says, as a former victim, she understands fighting back in self-defense. She says, I'm grateful that the owner was able to defend himself. Good for him for like being prepared, because in Baltimore, you never know what's going to happen. Indeed, Baltimore may see, may have a smaller number of murders this year. Carjackings, according to the Baltimore police, down 12% from this time in 2023. But crime has not been eradicated completely. You do still have the need to protect yourself. And thankfully, again, in Maryland, it is a little bit easier to do so than it was just a couple of years ago. Finally today, our good deed of the day. In the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. We're going to see a lot of stories like this over the next couple of days in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene. And I hope and I pray that if you were in Helene's path, that you are safe and sound and okay. My colleague Tom Knighton lives in southern Georgia. I was amazed that Tom didn't have major damage. In fact, didn't lose power. But, you know, again, we know that at least 95 people have passed away as a result of Hurricane Helene. There are hundreds more who are missing. The damage done to communities in Georgia and in western North Carolina, southwest Virginia, Kentucky, even Indiana, it is extensive. And again, we are going to be hearing a lot of stories of heroism, of neighbors coming together, of good people doing the right thing for you know, their family, their friends, and even complete strangers in the coming days. One such incident took place outside of Indianapolis, I guess maybe in Indianapolis, when a 80-foot-tall oak tree collapsed on a woman's car while she was inside. This happened Friday night, about 6 p.m., as the remnants of Hurricane Helene were still in the area. According to our friends at WIBC in Indianapolis, this 80-foot-tall oak tree, that's made to be about 200 years old, crashed onto this woman's gray SUV. It shattered the windshield, and then she's trapped inside. She was able to move to the back of the vehicle. Meanwhile, neighbors ran to see what happened. Todd Tetro and his neighbor, Terry Cool, saw what happened. WIBC reports that the two worked together to clear branches from the back of the car, which allowed just enough space for the woman to crawl out of the hatchback as paramedics were arriving on scene. The woman had almost no injuries, according to WIBC. Torn pants, missing pair of glasses. Tetralt said, it's unbelievable. You see the damage and you wonder how she wasn't hurt. Tree not only destroyed her car, took down power lines in the area, but neighbors continued to help by clearing the scene from debris. And again, helping to make sure that the woman herself was uninjured. So in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. The neighbors there, Todd Tetralt and Terry Kuhl, along with the other Good Samaritans, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program. As always, don't forget to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information. We've got the vice presidential debate taking place tomorrow night. And Tim Walz and J.D. Vance, I certainly hope that the Second Amendment is going to come up. Maybe Kamala Harris's thoughts on gun bans, not just bans on so-called assault weapons, but handguns as well. Did not come up during the debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, at least not on the part of the moderators, but hopefully, you know, at least one question dealing with the Second Amendment tomorrow night. Again, be sure to check out BearingArms.com. We'll keep you up to date on that and other stories. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.